Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. It's especially a privilege to be able to speak to you as we approach Armed Forces Day, and to do so in this first segment with one of the best national security reporters of our time. He is Bill Gertz, a featured guest here at Secure Freedom Radio, and a man who we follow closely, as I'm sure you do, in his Inside the Ring columns in the Washington Times, and of course, at the Washington Free Beacon, where he is a senior editor. Bill Gertz, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
You had a great piece this week. I featured a bit in it myself, I have to say, and thank you for that. But it was all about the peculiar situation we find ourselves in with respect to missile defense and the Russians. Talk to us about both sort of the backdrop to this in terms of how the Russians think about missile defense and how we're managing our relationship with them in that portfolio.
Yeah, this is a very important story because it relates to one of the key strategic defenses for the country. And those defenses are becoming more important. Just recently, we saw the threat emerging from North Korea, threats to attack us with nuclear missiles. We know that Iran is also working on longer range missiles. And the Obama administration is seeking to cut U.S. missile defenses as part of a deal to do further strategic offensive reductions with the Russians. And the piece that I did was highlighting the fact that behind the scenes, the Russian military is engaged in a large-scale, significant buildup of missile defense forces. At the same time, they're seeking legal limits on U.S. missile defenses. And when you couple that with their offensive strategic buildup, you have a very threatening situation. It's clear to me that Vladimir Putin, the Russian leader, is trying to recapture the threat from the Soviet Union as it relates to strategic nuclear forces.
Well, Bill, I remember from my days in the Pentagon, this was very much part of the playbook back then, that they would play this double game. They would negotiate, in that case, the 1972 Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty to really severely restrict our missile defenses, and then they proceeded to violate it and continued to build up theirs. And in your report at the Free Beacon, you have an array, I mean, quite stunning array of various missile defense systems that are being put into the field, some of which are being sold to some of our adversaries, but many of which are simply being used to defend the things that the Russians care about. And at the same time, that they're demanding that we essentially leave our people and assets very, very vulnerable. Thank you for covering that, as you always do. Bill, let me switch gears to China. You've got a series of stories on different parts of the threat emanating from there. You mentioned missiles that we should be worrying about, but let's talk about one in particular, the so-called DN2. What does that refer to, and what kind of capabilities are the Chinese acquiring in it?
Yeah, this is also a very significant story that I broke this week. On Monday, the Chinese military conducted the first flight test of a new anti-satellite missile, what they call a direct ascent missile. It's called the Dongning-2 or DN2, and it is a generation advance from the 2007 direct ascent missile, which was fired at a satellite. This test just went straight into space, and it was believed to be a high Earth orbit interceptor. In other words, this is a missile that can threaten strategic satellites, those that are used for communications, command and control, intelligence, and it represents a new level of threat from China. And we were the first to break it. The Pentagon initially had no comment, and then the day later they said, yes, this took place. We believe that it will be used as a anti-satellite interceptor.
Indeed. And as you say, strategic satellites at high altitude as well as others. Bill, let me ask you about another aspect of the Chinese threat, namely The kind of cyber espionage and cyber warfare capabilities that are increasingly being identified by you, among others, with the Chinese government itself. This plausible deniability of old seems to be over the side. Talk about the latest revelation that you've come across.
Yeah, I did a story this week also in the Free Beacon, which revealed that a computer science laboratory at Wuhan University, that's in the south central Sichuan province, has been identified by U.S. intelligence as a key component of the Chinese cyber warfare capabilities. And in fact, I was able to identify an actual training system that is used by up to 20 cyber warriors simultaneously to conduct foreign attacks. And this is further evidence of what we've already known. There's been several other the Beijing North Computing Center, and also this facility near Shanghai. So now we have a third facility. The Chinese are still in the complete denial phase, as they are with their anti-satellite weapons program. They insist they have no cyber warfare program, and yet we still keep seeing these important revelations about the military hacking core.
Yeah, and I think one example of the benefits that accrue to the Chinese from the aggressive work they do with these kinds of components of their military, Bill Gertz, as you know, is ripping off our technology. Talk to us a little bit about the X-47B, the Navy's new remotely piloted sort of fighter-sized vehicle that they've launched off of the George W. Bush this week.
The military, the U.S. Navy launched this X-47B. It's an unmanned combat aerial vehicle. In other words, it's not just a small, you know, propeller-driven drone. This is a jet-sized, basically it's a combat jet without a pilot that's on board. The pilot is remote. And the Chinese also unveiled, almost simultaneously with the Navy test, a new version of their unmanned combat aerial vehicle. And this is a significant development for the Chinese. You know, I did some research recently at a recent arms show in China. The Chinese unveiled 60 unmanned aerial vehicles, several of which are armed with missiles, as are the Predators. So the Chinese are, by any objective measure, they appear to be on a war footing. And yet the U.S. seems to be relatively oblivious to this growing and emerging threat.
But let me just ask you, Bill, were there some striking similarities between the Chinese remotely piloted vehicle that they unveiled and the one that was launched off of the Bush this week?
Yes, very much, very similar in size and design. So it's clear that the Chinese, through their hacking, were probably able to get design information that they were able to incorporate it into their drone. We know that they've done that on a number of systems, including the Aegis battle management system, which is the heart of our missile defenses and our advanced Navy warship.
Which has two terrible effects. One, it greatly increases the threat from these kinds of weapons, of course, but it also means that the U.S. taxpayers are being ripped off of hard invested money that's supposed to go to our military, not to helping the Chinese. Bill, finally, let me quickly turn to a subject that you addressed in your Inside the Ring column. Again, our guest is Bill Gertz, the author of that column and also senior editor with the Washington Free Beacon, about political correctness in the military. Talk to us about that and what it portends.
Yeah, there was a recent report this week by the U.S. Northern Command talking about a jihadist terror threat, and yet the words Islam and terror were never mentioned. This has been part of an ongoing effort by the Obama administration to remove all references to Islam and jihad as part of their political correct approach to terrorism. And, of course, as you're well aware, this is a really detrimental effect on trying to really understand the nature of the enemy. And unless they do a better job of understanding that and speak truthfully about these threats, we're never going to be able to address them.
You couldn't be more right about that, Bill. Charles Johnson at the Daily Caller had a terrific piece yesterday about a manual that was produced by the Department of Homeland Security. And it really makes plain that we are supposed to be deferring and not giving any offense to Islam at every turn. And I really fear, as I think we saw in Boston with this FBI inquiries into interview with this jihadist, that we're being blinded to a real threat, and this is hazardous in the extreme. Bill, you certainly are not being blinded by these or any of the other threats. In fact, nobody does a better job of chronicling them. Thank you for being with us, as always. It'll be great to talk with you again next week. In the meantime, keep up the good work and stay well. Next up, we will be speaking with Roger Noriega about some incredibly interesting and potentially ominous developments south of the border. Straight ahead.
Michael Medved is not afraid to say what others will not.
There is dysfunction at the heart of Islamic countries. Now, you can say it has nothing to do with true Islam. Okay, fine. That may be true. There were glorious years of Islamic civilization. But not in the last 400. I mean, for goodness sake.
Don't you see it before your eyes?
Is it wrong to point out?
The Michael Medved Show. Weekdays at 3, right before Hugh Hewitt at 6, on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is retired Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin. For over 7 months, the truth has been hidden about a terrorist attack that killed 4 Americans in Benghazi, Libya, last September 11th. We still don't know why our ambassador was in that dangerous place on a day Islamists have made dangerous for all of us, or why we were repeatedly told that a mob, not jihadist, killed him and his comrades, or why no effective rescue effort was mounted. So 700 of my fellow Special Forces veterans who have participated in such efforts in the past have teamed up to learn the truth and to ensure that something like this doesn't happen again. To see a copy of our open letter to House Speaker John Boehner calling for a real investigation of Benghazi Gate and to urge your representative to do the same, go to www.inthecoverup.com, a project of the Center for Security Policy. Thank you.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If you don't know where Bill Bennett stands, here are some of his beliefs.
I believe Americans should largely do much more for themselves than many Americans are doing.
But do I rule out government as something that might be able to assist in that? And that I do not.
I do think families, churches, and schools are better places for that to happen. People should do for themselves what they can. Government should do what people cannot do for themselves.
Get to know Bill Bennett, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by Roger Noriega, our duty guy on Latin America, the man who has come to these areas of responsibility the old-fashioned way. He earned it. He worked in the George W. Bush administration as an Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs, also as an representative of the United States to the Organization of American States, among many other incarnations he had on Capitol Hill and elsewhere in the government. And Roger, it's always great to have you with us. Thanks for finding a few minutes.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Let's start with Venezuela, as we often do with you. There is an increasing body of evidence that the wheels are coming off the Chavismo experiment there. Talk to us a little bit about what's happening to the economy, to what's left of freedom of the press, and what the government is trying to do about it all.
Well, any successor to Hugo Chavez would have had trouble keeping things together. The economy's in a meltdown. Personal crime is out of control. The oil production is down 40% since before Chavez was elected. Chinese have closed their checkbook. All of this is incredibly difficult to manage. And then you have a really incompetent guy who stole an election, I think, on April 14th, Nicolas Maduro, who's not able to hold this together. His economic advisors are from Cuba, for crying out loud. So we didn't expect very much, and I think that the country is going to be facing a very serious crisis in the year ahead.
And GloboVision, one of the last remaining independent media, is now over the side. How does that fit into all of this?
Well, the Chavismo has strangled any kind of independent voices in the country. They went after GloboVision by harassing its owners and then applying these fines, incredibly difficult for the companies to sustain. So they had to sell their interests in GloboVision, and Chavista is taking over the head of that last remaining independent voice, really, in the country.
Well, that won't be good either. We're joined, as we have the privilege of being with regularity, by our expert on Latin America here at Secure Freedom Radio, Roger Noriega. Roger is currently with the American Enterprise Institute and the founder and driving force behind InterAmericanSecurityWatch.com. We were talking a bit about Venezuela. You mentioned Cuban advisors helping bankrupt the place. There was a stunningly interesting report out of Cuba this week concerning the future leadership of the place. Tell us about it, and what do you make of it?
Well, Raul Castro apparently has let out that he would consider leaving earlier, may have to turn over power early. He is an old man, but I think, quite frankly, these are all distractions. It's like from the old Godfather movie, that old man thinks he's going to live forever. And quite frankly, this is the way they sort of bleed off political pressure and give some sort of pretense that there's an actual transition underway. Frankly, I think what's happening there is a regime that's breathing its last breath, that's holding on to the Venezuelan largesse with both hands, and if they lose that battle, they really have no room for sustaining power in the country. So it's a little bit of whistling past the graveyard, a little bit of diversion, which the Castros are very, very good at.
Indeed. Do you have any insight, Roger Noriega, as to who might in fact succeed at whatever point these guys finally exit the stage, the two Castro brothers?
Well, he named after his last election, Raul named a successor from within the regime, who, quite frankly, I just think that the idea that Castro is going to be able to hold on to power for another 5 years and turn over power in some sort of orderly transition to somebody who's equally unelected and illegitimate is laughable. I think we need to focus on the free-thinking Democrats who are emerging in the international stage today, who talk about simple human rights, talk about a democratic form of government, who talk about free markets as a way for saving Cuba. It's really remarkable the sophistication of these people within Cuba who are emerging on the stage, and they're just so much more positive about the future of Cuba than these Castro clones.
Well, we will be following that, needless to say, closely with you, Roger Noriega. Let me turn to another Latin American country closer to our border, namely Mexico. The Mexican government that has come to power as a result of the recent election there has, as we've been discussing for some time, indicated that it is going to effect a change in the direction of its anti-narcotics activities. And as you and I have been discussing, Roger, this seems to be beginning to manifest itself in a number of ways. There's a report that this includes now greater restrictions on U.S. drug enforcement personnel and operations in Mexico. Talk a little bit about that and whether this bodes ill for trying to really stem the hemorrhage of these illegal drugs into our country.
Well, when the current president, Enrique Peña Nieto, took power at the beginning of the year, some of us were worried about what might happen when an operative of an apparatchik of the old PRI that governed Mexico for 70 years and dealt with the narcos through pacts and truces, what he might do. And quite frankly, I think the other shoe is kind of dropping here after 6 or more years of the United States and Mexico working very, very close together on this narco threat in unprecedented ways. The Peña Nieto administration has begun to sort of channel these communications through top-level folks, and it will stir a lot of doubt in U.S. law enforcement when these political people are very high up are going to be the bottleneck in kind of operational cooperation that's necessary to get their arms around these narco operatives. So I think I would have hoped to think that President Obama would have raised this with Peña Nieto during his visit there to say, look, we're going to be watching what results your new policy produces because Mexico can't let down its guard against this threat. And at the same time, we need to do more materially and politically to bolster Mexico in this fight because it's a fight that we have to share responsibility in.
A very considerable stake. Is there any evidence that this was, in fact, a topic between the two presidents?
Well, the president talked about it at an otherwise lackluster press conference, and his message was right then. But quite frankly, he's a guy that, unfortunately, with all due respect, avoids these kinds of confrontations and in a strange way when American interests are at stake.
Indeed. Strange is an understatement, I think. Roger Noriega, the American Enterprise Institute and Inter-American Security Watch is our guest. Lastly, let's turn to Brazil, a country that is very much on the move in the hemisphere and indeed internationally. InterAmericanSecurityWatch.com, Roger, has picked up a report that NPR filed to the effect that Brazil is now taking on an enormously ambitious enterprise, namely building a 10,000-mile virtual fence to cover some of the areas most remote and undeveloped, inaccessible, in fact, in the world, among other places, to try to deal with the problem that it's having with illegal immigration and drug trafficking and so on. Might there be lessons in what the Brazilians are doing for us as well?
Well, I think the Brazilians are going to probably look to see what we've done on this front and do the opposite to be more efficient. We've been battling this for a decade and trying to find intelligent ways to tend to the security on our southwest border in particular. But this is something that they need to do from a standpoint of controlling exploitation of resources, drug trafficking, their basic national security, perhaps that they will have better luck than we've had. But it really is important. It underscores that a country like Brazil is tending to its national territory, integrity, and sovereignty. And we certainly have every right and obligation to do the same thing here.
Indeed, we should. Roger Noriega, we have to leave it at that. Thank you very much for joining us. As always, your perspectives on the hemisphere are indispensable to understand the problems that are existing in our front yard and what we need to be doing about it. We'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, we'll be talking in honor of Armed Forces Day with Elaine Donnelly, one of the great champions of our armed forces.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Frank Gaffney. Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaev's kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Tomorrow is Armed Forces Day, when we are asked to honor those who put their lives on the line for the rest of us. The least we can do is thank a serviceman or woman. But honestly, that's something we should all do every day. Here's something else we should resolve to do on this occasion and from now on. Tell our elected representatives to really support the troops. That means ensuring that they have the weapons, other equipment, and training they need to secure our freedom. And we must stop subjecting the military to social experimentation that burdens its personnel with politically driven agendas and distracts them from their vital missions. We live in dangerous times. Let's do our part for those who stand between us and such dangers. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
This is retired Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin. For over 7 months, the truth has been hidden about a terrorist attack that killed 4 Americans in Benghazi, Libya, last September 11th. We still don't know why our ambassador was in that dangerous place on a day Islamists have made dangerous for all of us, or why we were repeatedly told that a mob, not jihadist, killed him and his comrades, or why no effective rescue effort was mounted. So 700 of my fellow Special Forces veterans who have participated in such efforts in the past have teamed up to learn the truth and to ensure that something like this doesn't happen again. To see a copy of our open letter to House Speaker John Boehner calling for a real investigation of Benghazi Gate, and to urge your representative to do the same, go to www.inthecoverup.com, a project of the Center for Security Policy. Thank you.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
It's a very great pleasure to welcome back Elaine Donnelly. She is a personal heroine of mine, having served for many years at the forefront of one of the most difficult and
frankly, the most important issues with respect to national security, namely the effort that has been made for years now, but most especially under the Obama administration, to use our military as a kind of instrument for social experimentation of various kinds. And no one has been more clear-eyed about the dangers associated with that for the only military we have, and more authoritative in her analysis of the problem and more articulate in her warnings than has our guest. She is the president and the founder and driving force behind a terrific organization, the Center for Military Readiness. And it is always, as I say, a great treat to have her with us, especially given the topics that are at hand at the moment. Elaine, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Frank, and thank you for all your work. The military is a very, very important institution. As you say, it's the only one that we have. We worry about the funding and the hardware and all the things that go into making our military the very best, but there needs to be more attention given to the people in the military and the political forces that are hurting morale, that are hurting discipline, that are showing up in very embarrassing ways for the administration. Indicators of sexual assault need to be taken seriously. But not in the way the Pentagon keeps doing. They just want to sweep all these numbers under the rug.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the numbers. Let's talk about your insights into the problem. There has, it seems, been some underreporting in some instances, perhaps, some cases of overreporting. What's the truth of the matter as you see it? Is there an epidemic of sexual abuse or sexual assaults taking place in the military today?
Oh, I think it is real. The Department of Defense Office of Sexual Assault Prevention and Response, it's called SAPRO. Every year they come out with a report. And I knew that in the new one that just came out last week, there would be more bad news, and certainly there was. It turns out that sexual assaults of military personnel have increased by 129% since 2004, and by 98% if you look at all of the reports sent to the Department of Defense. By any measure, this is a record of failure. We also find that there are 17% of sexual assault allegations that were found to be unfounded in 2012, and that's up from a 13% level in 2009. But going from 13 to 17%, that's a 34% increase. So the issues of false accusations are also still there, and they hurt people who are falsely accused. And I can tell you the Pentagon's doing nothing about that problem. Then we see numbers involving men and sexual assault. 12% unrestricted reports involved men. And yet that, too, is an issue that doesn't come up. We keep hearing everything is fine.
This would be men who are the victims of sexual assault, presumably by other men?
Only 2% of the subjects, which means perpetrators, are women. So we can draw the conclusion that 98% are men. On that whole issue, hardly anything is being said. There was also a survey done that showed that, get this, and a lot of people are astonished to hear this, but according to this survey, the one that's used to argue for more funding for this office, we find out that according to the New York Times, there are more men who are victims of sexual assault, or said they were, than we see the numbers of women.
Wow. And this is before, really, this whole gaze in the military.
Oh, no, this is over the last 2 years since the law was repealed.
Well, since the law is repealed is more recent than that, isn't it? Is it 2 years now already? The time flies by. So we've seen a formalization of the right of homosexuals to serve in the military. Do you draw a correlation between their presence now above board and these assaults in the men on men?
What is in common between both sets of victims is the theory that sexuality doesn't matter, that training programs alone are enough to control human impulses that are inappropriate and harmful in the military. I'm particularly concerned, though, about the greater numbers of people involved with the issue of women in combat, which Congress needs to do something about. They need to intervene because really ridiculous arguments are being made. For instance, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, claimed that this issue of sexual assaults against women might be improved if they are put into direct ground combat units, battalions. fighting battalions. This is ludicrous. We have not heard this since Pat Schroeder, right after the Tailhook scandal.
A former member of Congress, very controversial leftist at that.
That's right. After the Tailhook scandal, a lot of aviators, both men and women, drinking, partying wildly at Las Vegas Hotel. She said, well, let's put women in combat aviation, and that problem of assault will be helped. Well, her theory is in shreds, because respect for women is very high. But these rates of sexual assault just keep escalating higher and higher. And yet we hear the same discredited theory being used to say, well, let's put women into the combat arms. And our advice is to both Congress and to the Pentagon, look, first, do no harm. Do not extend this problem into the infantry, the armor, special operations forces, Navy SEALs. We don't need these problems to be introduced.
Until you get your hands around this, at the very least, that only makes sense, Elaine Donnelly, that you've got such a dramatic problem on your hands now. How anybody could think that the right course of action here is to expand the opportunities for it to be made even worse. And yet, as you say, and again, our guest is Elaine Donnelly, the president of the Center for Military Readiness. As you say, Elaine, we've been hearing a lot of bunk out of senior military leaders, notably the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin Dempsey. Tell me, as you see it, what, given what we have experienced to this point, is the predictable effect, not simply in terms of additional instances of sexual attack or assault or rape or whatever, but of pregnancies and difficulties with the good order and discipline of units and so on, if these MOSs, as they're called, the military specialties, actually are now opened up in increasing numbers to women.
It's time to pause and look at this big picture, including the elements you just mentioned. You have escalating numbers of sexual assault. You have escalating numbers of false accusations of sexual assault. You have issues, deployability, affected by things that happen on the other end of the spectrum, namely romantic relationships that result in pregnancy and that hurt morale and unit cohesion because two people who pair off exclude everyone else. You take all of these issues and you transfer them into nine-man squads in the infantry, and if you do it in a way that you have to lower standards in order to accommodate women, General Dempsey, again, said, well, if the standard's too high, we'll just ask the question, why does it have to be that high? When you take all of these factors together, you really weaken our military. Every pillar of military culture, in the best sense of the word, people are slamming military culture, forgetting that its departure from the high values and core values of the military that are leading to all of these problems. And the leaders in the military are clueless, because they don't seem to understand the value of the basic things that make our military as strong as it is.
Or they're not being allowed to cling to those, I think, is really as much a problem as anything. Let me ask you, Elaine Donnelly, finally, what should we be doing about this? First, do no harm, as you say. Is there any other redress that you think is in order?
Yes. Congress can put into law what we're calling sound policy for women in the military. And what it would do is lay the baseline down. Do not gender integrate the infantry, armor, special operations forces, and the like. Do not do that. Congress needs to put that in law. Congress has the authority to do that under the United States Constitution. Secondly, we have to stop using legal words about standards. Not gender neutral when it really means gender normed would be harmful in the infantry. So we have to clarify that issue. Congress can do this in the Defense Authorization Bill. And frankly, I think it would have bipartisan support.
Well, it certainly should. And with your leadership at the Center for Military Readiness, it hopefully will get both the consideration it deserves and the support. Please keep us apprised and report back quickly. We'd like to make sure that this gets attention both here in Washington and elsewhere around the country. Thanks for your great work, Elaine Donnelly, at the Center for Military Readiness. Keep it up.
Thank you.
Know that, as the president likes to say, we got your back. Next up, Claudia Rosette on the latest example of anti-Americanism at the United Nations that you are paying for. Straight ahead.
The ambassador of civil discourse, Dennis Prager.
That a liberal does not recognize that there is a secular left brainwash.
And
virtually every university in the United States.
I've said this probably 1,000 times. I don't mind that the New York Times is left. I mind that there are people who deny it's left.
The Dennis Prager Show. Weekdays at noon. Right before Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
This is retired Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin. For over 7 months, the truth has been hidden about a terrorist attack that killed 4 Americans in Benghazi, Libya last September 11th. We still don't know why our ambassador was in that dangerous place on a day Islamists have made dangerous for all of us, or why we were repeatedly told that a mob, not jihadist, killed him and his comrades, or why no effective rescue effort was mounted. So 700 of my fellow Special Forces veterans who have participated in such efforts in the past have teamed up to learn the truth and to ensure that something like this doesn't happen again. To see a copy of our open letter to House Speaker John Boehner calling for a real investigation of Benghazi Gate and to urge your representative to do the same, go to www.inthecoverup.com, a project of the Center for Security Policy. Thank you.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq-Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Mike Gallagher doesn't apologize for speaking the truth.
People are not economically equal. They never have been.
They never will be.
But we believe in giving people the opportunity to try to become financially successful.
How are you going to make a janitor economically equal to a CEO?
But that's what this fierce liberal mindset tries to suggest. And then everybody's happy. Right?
Right.
Wrong.
The Mike Gallagher Show. Weekdays from 9 to noon on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by one of my personal favorites in the pantheon of extraordinary investigative reporters and observers of the national security and foreign policy scene. She is a journalist of great distinction with many years of experience with such estimable outfits as the Wall Street Journal. She currently has a column for Forbes.com, and she is a blogger at Pajamas Media, where you'll find her under the Rosette Report. She is, of course, Claudia Rosette. Claudia, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Thanks, Frank. Great to be here.
You have recently written a piece that, again, is just as is so much of what you do, a marvelous vehicle for understanding what we're up against in terms of this international community, as it's described, specifically the United Nations. And talk to us a little bit about this chap, Richard Falk.
as a kind of an exemplar of the rot in that institution and its virulent anti-Americanism and anti-Israel sentiment.
Yeah, Richard Falk, now in his 80s, was for a long time a professor of international law at Princeton. He's American. And also a great enthusiast of things like the Iranian Islamic Revolution, about which he enthused at the time. An advocate of basically the interests of the Palestinian Liberation Organization for years.
Oh, that's and, a great thing to be done.
He has served off and on, most recently appointed in 2008 as somebody working for the UN Human Rights Council. His current post is Special Rapporteur on the Palestinian, as the UN has it, the Palestinian Occupied Territories. Although the description there, when they apply it to Gaza, which is actually occupied by Hamas, not by
the
Israelis who withdrew, right?
They're formerly occupied by the Israeli territory.
Yeah, but the UN hasn't caught up. But Richard Falk, in this capacity as Special Rapporteur, got a lot of attention recently because he wrote an article which appeared both on the sort of boutique left-wing blog and on Al Jazeera website, blaming the Boston Marathon on what he called the Global American Domination Project. He called this blowback, the natural post-colonial response. In other words, he blamed America for the horrific bombings in Boston that maimed and killed and so on.
This makes one's stomach churn, but what does a special rapporteur do when he's not fomenting, you know, antipathy towards the United States and excusing its enemies?
Well, it's a very interesting sort of position created by the UN. It looks like it's this great philanthropic endeavor because these rapporteurs make very little. They make maybe a token dollar a year, usually, for their services. But, of course, what they get for that is the UN pays their expenses to go travel around and look into whatever their area of specialization is supposed to be, and provides them a platform. They deliver reports to the UN Human Rights Council and to the General Assembly. So they go to Geneva, they go to New York, they get a lot of attention. In other words, it's a huge free megaphone subsidized by you, the U.S. taxpayer.
Give us a sense of not only the size of the megaphone, but the size of the expense accounts.
Hundreds of thousands of dollars. UN Watch, which is based in Geneva and keeps a close eye on the Human Rights Council in particular, looked into this and pointed out, and so has George Russell at Fox News. And between them, they've reported that these special rapporteurs get in expenses sort of anywhere on the order from $400,000 to $600,000 worth of travel, materials.
But so, Claudia, just to cut to the chase, is this the exception or the rule at the United Nations that we're underwriting people who, as I say, foster hatred for the United States and its ally Israel?
Right. This is the rule. In fact, one of the previous rapporteurs who was sort of quietly disappeared from the scene about 2 years ago was an envoy of Libya, who had chaired the disgraced former Human Rights Commission, Najat al-Hajjaji, and was another of their rapporteurs. And there's a further piece of this that's recently come to light that is truly egregious. These rapporteurs are apparently not required to disclose money that they receive from other sources. In other words, they can receive funding from whomever they want. They're not actually considered UN employees, although even for employees, the UN's conflict of interest policies are very
lax,
loose and
shall
opaque.
We say. Yeah.
But for these rapporteurs,
there's no policy at
visible.
All.
Correct. So they could be receiving money from virtually anybody. And there's no requirement by the Human Rights Council that they disclose it. And the kicker is, neither does the Human Rights Council have any provision for firing them.
Oh,
so,
Claudia,
they get this position.
I can't bear it. I can't bear a single minute more of this. This is just what makes me crazy about the United Nations and I think would inflame any right-thinking American. And again, we're speaking with one of the people who has done more to expose this kind of rot in the United Nations. Relations. Claudia Rosette, now a journalist in residence at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. And Claudia, I hate to tear away from that particular travesty, but let me take advantage of your expertise with a couple of other countries that are very much on our minds at the moment, or should be, just to get a quick sense from you as to what is happening and whether they too should be of concern to us. You've closely monitored developments in North Korea for a long time. What do you make at the moment of what is happening there, and should it be considered a real threat to this country and our allies and interests in the region?
It's an enormous threat. It has been for some time, and it is getting worse at speed. And look, North Korea, there is no evidence that North Korea is interested in giving up its nuclear program. That regime depends on it. It's been built around it for a long time. And we have seen behavior. You know, there was hope when dictator number two in this dynastic totalitarian Kim family died, when Kim Jong-il died in late 2011, that his son might be, you know, for a while, I was not among those who subscribed to this hope. I think the regime is what it is. And until it's gone, this is what we'll continue to have. The nightmare problems and Stalinist level abuses of human rights internally that have been the rule there.
And but the fact that they treat their people so badly is an indicator, I think it's fair to say, of how little regard they have for everybody else's people, don't you think?
Well, it tells you, of course, it tells you what their priorities and policies are. And this is a country that exports what it makes, and it exports them, among other places. A big market has been the rogue regimes of the Middle East, and a big, big partner in proliferation.
Well, basically, the only thing it makes to speak of is weaponry of various kinds, missiles, and increasingly now we're concerned about nuclear weapons. This is a cash crop that is exported at our peril for sure. Claudia, quickly, let me segue to the enabler of this North Korean regime that you've described so eloquently, China. We've had a report out of the Pentagon in recent days describing its militarism, buildup, and aggression. Worrying as well?
Very worrying. You know, as the U.S. retreats and withdraws and shrinks into itself, there's a vacuum out there. And China is looking at that. And the great pity, the real tragedy here is, yeah, China has reached some China has been for some time at this crossroads where the question has been, is it going to take this militaristic road? And we see the rise of what is, in many ways, fits the definition of a fascist state, or is it going to continue along the road of becoming a capitalist power with loosening politics and sort of evolving into something where the great
party we can do business with, as they say. Claudia, this is the question we will come back to you on, I hope, in the very near future. Claudia Rosette with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Also, you can read her wonderful writing at the Rosette Report at PJ Media. Come back to us again very soon, if you would, Claudia. I hope the rest of you will do so as well. Same time, same station next week. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening. Good Armed Forces Day.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.